Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 448-2295. But please hold your calls. Right now we have with us on the line from Colorado, Bruce Brander, and we've interviewed Bruce before on a book that he wrote called Staring into Chaos. It really was one of my favorite books, just talking about what philosophers have written about past societies and how America has turned its back on everything that it once stood for. Now, looking down the road, we are going the same way that all great societies have gone before, and because we have turned our back on our religious and spiritual heritage, and that is what happened to all great societies in the past. Well, unfortunately, the book went out of print. I only printed a few thousand copies, and I thought that was a terrible loss because we had actually carried the book here, or we had requests for it, and suddenly it wasn't available. And so we lost contact with Bruce until he came out with a new book called Love That Works. Now, I usually don't read or talk about philosophic books, and especially books on love, but considering Bruce had written it, and of course Bruce is a fascinating individual, he's been a correspondent, he's traveled throughout the world to war zones, and now of course he's come home, he's retired, I think, well I don't know if he's retired, he's writing and doing a lot of things, and he'd written a book on love. That may seem sort of a trite thing to write about, but I think you'll find it a fascinating subject. He's done a wonderful job. It's a short book. It's really only about 160 pages in length, and yet it's a fascinating read, and I read it through from beginning to end, and I would recommend it to anyone out there who's married, who's going to get married, who hopes to get married. It is such an important book because it gives you an outlook on the relationship of a man and a woman that really is the very foundation of our society, and we see half of our marriages ending in divorce, and they don't have to, they shouldn't, and yet, well, Bruce, what really motivated you to write this book?
Well, Dr. Stan, it's good to be back with you for one thing. And just to correct something, I'm not really retired, I'm just not traveling as much.
All right, fine.
Because I've got three teenage kids at home and one almost in their teens, so I feel I ought to stay home more often than charging around the world. So I've taken to writing books that I had notes for a long time, and this particular one I wrote out of compassion, essentially. It began a long time ago when I was in university. I entered university late at the age of 22 after 4 years of traveling as a merchant seaman and as a soldier, and I was all ready to settle down at the age of 22 and get married and have kids, and I did question the kind of love that our society is promoting. I'd hear these pop songs on the radio, and they didn't sound quite right. All the sadness and the ecstasy and what all, it sounded fishy, really. But I overcame my own good judgment and went along with the society, and ended up engaged and then backing out of the engagement, and suffering a considerable amount of personal, emotional pain as a consequence. And then I began to realize and notice and hear that people all around me were suffering as this rather severe pain, very severe pain in some cases. And out of sheer compassion, I figured, well, if this is love, we shouldn't have this. We should have something better. So I began researching in a casual way, even when I was in university. And then later on, much later, I had been working at National Geographic, left the job.
Hold that thought right there.
Yeah, you bet.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Bruce Brander. And he's going into the background of why he wrote a book on love, love that works. And, of course, as a young man, involved in an engagement, broken engagement, and then he's working at National Geographic. So you pick up the story there.
Yes, I was working at National Geographic as a writer and editor, and I spent about 4 years there, and then I left there and went to Europe and burrowed myself into a library in a European university, and began to study the phenomena of love in all of its aspects, the history and the philosophy, theology, and the whole lot, the psychology of it. And gradually, over a long period of time, about 30 years, it all came together into a fairly succinct book. I had planned to have the book done within 2 years, and it took about 30. And the book that came out is, I believe, quite a definitive work on what love is and how we can do it successfully. And that's Love That Works.
Well, I think you've done a wonderful job. And, of course, some of the things you point out are things that we really don't think about here in the West. You pointed out that in many societies, the match is actually made by the families. The families decide who's going to get married. The romance that we seem so addicted to here, a romance that shines brightly for a time and then fades, and suddenly the horror, suddenly finding yourself married, and all the romance may be gone. But that really doesn't exist in many societies before the couples are married.
Well, actually, the romantic-type bond is forbidden in some societies. The Aborigines consider a woman, the Australian Aborigines, tribal people, traditionally considered a woman who married from romantic longings to be nothing better than a prostitute. And in Korea, until 1910, romantic marriages were forbidden by law. And in the European society, they were very, very distrusted for many, many centuries, because romance is so impermanent, it's so capricious, it's so unstable. And the people I have encountered several people who came from societies where marriages are still arranged, and they're confident that their parents will fix them up with very suitable matches, and that love will develop out of simple good-heartedness. They're not loveless marriages, they're marriages where people are expected to treat each other in a way that generates love. And ironically, the people who have arranged marriages tend to look upon our system and upon the people who get caught in these romances as being very pitiable and tense and strained and unhappy, and they feel sorry for us.
And of course, that's the point that you make, and I think, there we missed that break, but that's all right. I'm sure our listeners now who've joined us again will forgive me for not reintroducing you. Our guest this evening is Bruce Brander. His book is Love That Works, and Bruce has written a wonderful story about what love is about, and of course, talking about the ideas we have of love. And one enchanted evening, we see our love across the room, and suddenly, our life is never the same after that. And it's a wonderful story, but how long does that love really last? Whereas, as Bruce points out, and I think very, very rightly so, that certainly love is something that grows through the years, and people could not even know one another when they're married, and yet that love, that respect, that closeness could increase through the years, but both sides really have to work at it to make it successful.
Well, yes, the way we love simply is not working for us anymore. And no serious endeavor in society, our whole society, fails so often and so dismally as romance. We see its failure just everywhere in our lives, our hearts, our divorce courts. Most of us personally have suffered sorrow and disappointment and disillusion in our own romances. In fact, I heard on the radio just today a woman saying, And I quote here, I wrote down what she said. She said, "I didn't trust the words 'I love you.' To me, they just meant pain." And many people are in that condition because their romances are a roller coaster ride to nowhere, ecstasy, and then depression. And their painful attempts at a lasting relationship that doesn't work out. And it's statistically, the average American goes through between 7 and 10 romances in the course of a lifetime. And of course, most of those don't work out. And sociologists find that 50%, they've done surveys on college campuses, and found that 50% of the people coming out of romances, out of failed romances, suffer considerably severe depression, and 25% have suicidal thoughts, which amazed me, but not so much when I think back. I've known three women, young women myself, who seriously attempted suicide after romances. And we don't talk about this very much. We hide the pains of modern romance. It's somehow socially unacceptable to reveal it. And that's why most people still think of romance as hearts and flowers, when it's really the way we've debased romance, the way we deal with it in such a selfish way, it causes us enormous injury. And even just to continue for a moment, even when romance brings us into marriage, our chances of success are statistically the same as the flip of a coin, 50-50, as you pointed out. And I often say if we were facing the same odds for an airplane trip, we wouldn't go.
that's an excellent point.
And well, that's the situation most young people find themselves in now. They don't want to go.
Well, the problem is, because what happens in other societies? I mean, here everything has been based upon dating, and many societies, why, they don't allow dating. Certainly in many South American societies, a boy and a girl are never allowed to be together, you know, without a chaperone until they're actually betrothed or actually they're actually married.
Well, yeah, in the book that we're dealing with, Love That Works, I have a chapter on the history of love, and love does change from one age to the next. It's imperceptible because it changes a bit each generation. But in our time, in the past 100 years, it's changed from a more generous form of romance where people were kind and considerate and watched out for each other's welfare into a rather crude and callous and cold type of predatory romance, a very hungry romance where we're seeking to essentially find somebody to feed on. And that kind of romance, of course, is going to cause great disappointment because the people are going to devour each other.
And, of course, one of the big problems we have is that people get mixed up between sex and romance and love, and there's a great deal of difference between all of them.
Yeah, that's right. And as I say, failed romance is one of life's most devastating experiences, and it doesn't just harm us, it harms families and children even more. A divorce rate, for example, the scale of marital breakdown in the West since 1960 has no historical precedent. There's been nothing like it for at least 2,000 years and probably never. And the British Medical Journal pointed out that because marriage is in trouble, so are the children.
And so is society. And this really is what people don't understand, is that what we have now is not working. I mean, at one time, people were married, and they were married in the sight of God, and this was not something you were going to try. This was for life. There was just no question about it. I mean, divorce was not an option. And certainly the Catholic Church still holds to that, although they've turned their back on it. The Protestant Church has been much more understanding, and in the due process has resulted in the destruction of so many lives.
Well, yes, and the children particularly, because according to the British Medical Journal, they note that parenting is probably the biggest public health issue facing our society, because it's the largest single variable implicated in childhood diseases and accidents and teenage pregnancy and drug abuse, truancy, school disruption, underachievement, the whole lot. I mean, it's related to faulty parenting that's occurring because marriages break apart. And a minority of children today live with both biological parents. And that really has a serious damaging effect upon the children.
It sure does, and we see this especially in the black family, where 70% of children are born to an unwed mother, born out of wedlock, 25%, in the white community, and growing, of course. But the problem is that this is simply a reflection of failed romance, and people acting irresponsibly, not understanding that sex is not something you just have a good time with, but this is something that bonds people together forever. And then when that breaks up, why that bond is still there?
Well, and people don't really understand, as I didn't myself years ago, that there are other kinds of love, that romance as we practice it is not the only kind of love. The media primarily, excuse me, I know you're part of the media and so am I. I'm not implicating everybody. But
we're different than the rest of them, though, Bruce. Go ahead.
But the media generally pushes this kind of love at us. For what reason, I have no idea. I think they're just making profit off the libido. That they push this kind of faulty romantic love at us, this raw, base, carnal type of romance, and of course, it we believe the media, and we tend to think that this is the only kind of love there is. That it's the only game in town, and really, it's a very deficient love. It's not wrong in itself, but it's not enough. Romance is not enough, and that's really the point of this book. The first half of Love That Works points out that the flaws in modern romance, which are, I think, really, I'm reminding people of them because we see them all the time. And the second half goes into the kinds of love that are available to anybody, that anybody can do, that will work. They're virtually guaranteed to work. I say virtually because sometimes we'll run across a partner who just does not want a generous kind of love, who wants the thrills and excitement of romance, a romance junkie. There are such people, but if they want something lasting, something warm, something committed, that is available to any of us, and that's what the second half of the book is about.
Well, I think it would be a wonderful primer for really any young person who's thinking about going out and dating. But you really have to really give some serious thought and consideration. I wish I'd had this book available for me about 65 years ago when I was first beginning to come of age.
Well, I sure wish I'd had it when I was in my 20s. It would have helped me a lot because my heart was in the right place, but my head wasn't.
Well,
you mentioned dating, Dr. Stan. We don't realize that a lot of these things are fairly recent in history, fairly recent creation. Dating did not occur before about the 1920s. Before then, they had serious courtship, which was aimed at marriage. It wasn't a casual thing. It was a very, very serious, almost like a commitment. If a man began to see a woman, he'd be chaperoned at first, and then they'd be allowed to walk out together. But the idea was marriage would be at the end of it, whereas dating came along as sort of a breezy, casual entertainment with no commitment at all. And some people are getting back to the courtship idea and forgetting about dating altogether, realizing that, of course, dating has injured a great many people and debilitated them from marriage later on. And things like necking, for example, that was a custom that did not occur before the 1920s. We think of these things as engraved in stone, handed down with the Ten Commandments, but they weren't. They're all quite new, quite recent arrangements, and since they came into play, the divorce rate has shot up.
This is one of the major problems with our society, because if you destroy the basic building block of society, you destroy the society. And this is one reason why America as a nation is in real trouble today. It's because we've lost the foundation of our family. Well, if you're out there in the listening audience, you have a question or comment on this subject, and let me recommend the book to you. It's Love That Works. In fact, we're even carrying the book because we just think it's an important book, a wonderful gift for any young person who is coming of age, I'm sure even for people who've been involved in romances that have fallen apart, or really for anybody who's married, because I think there's so much wisdom in this. 30 years of wisdom and study and thought went into this short little book, and yet, of course, it says, I think, everything that needs to be said, a definitive text on love, which, of course, is something that does not necessarily lead to marriage, but I think just the contrary, marriage can lead to love. Would that be a fair statement, Bruce?
Yes, it can. It can. And romance can lead to love, too, as long as we don't stop with romance. That's what the issue is today we think that romance is all there is to love and we stop there, whereas we should proceed, and that's the second half of the book, Love as It Works.
All right, fine. We're going to be back here in just a moment. And again, we'll welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you're interested in knowing more about getting the book, well, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. The author is Bruce Brander, who we've had the pleasure of course, talking about on his other, at least the last book he wrote. I don't know how many he's written altogether, but a fascinating, fascinating book. I read in print as well. Well, our Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, our guest this evening, Bruce Brander, his book, Love That Works, and the fascinating insight just into what is love really all about. Well, of course, people used to say love makes the world go round, and it does, certainly without reproduction, why society wouldn't exist at all. But love is far more than simply sex or reproduction. Love is a personal relationship, and I think it's really brought out so beautifully in the book as we go through it. And, of course, you talk about love rediscovered. Going a little bit into some of the things that John Doe had said, that our affections kill us, not nor die. Why don't you go ahead and just simply develop some of the thoughts that you have there in the last half of the book about how we are able to really make love succeed.
Yes, Dr. Stan. When I was still single, I married rather late in life, and when I was still single, I was so delighted to discover that there are better and higher and more reliable forms of love than modern-style romance. And I found this in history, I found it in theology, in psychology. Psychologists don't really, for the most part, think very highly of our form of romance. They think of it as kind of a psychosis, where we get an idealized image of a person and project that upon someone else, like a movie on a screen. And then when that person doesn't live up to our ideals, we're disillusioned. Disillusion is a byword of modern romance. And we are angry at the person for not meeting our needs, etc. And I found that there are different kinds of higher forms of love that are dedicated to a greater generosity. The Greek philosophers, who were probably the finest psychologists of all time, had three words for romance, which are really very useful to keep in mind for us, or three words for love, rather. And they had more than that, but the three basic kinds of love were eros and philia and agape. And some people are familiar with those terms and some are not. But eros is essentially a description of our kind of romance. It wasn't sex. They had another word for that. Eros doesn't just want sex, it wants the whole person. And that's what romance does. We want the whole person, and we can eros love any number of things because it's a love that reaches out to draw something into our life to fulfill ourselves. And we can, in a trivial way, we can eros love chocolate because that fulfills us momentarily, or we can eros love a car. We can, on a very high level, we can eros love God. Religious people can eros love God because God provides a spiritual fulfillment for them. And we also can eros love another person. That is, see the person across the crowded room, you know, and figure that person will fulfill us, will make our life complete. And that's what romance does. The next level of love is not as self-centered. Romance is very, very selfish. It's about my feelings, my emotions, my desires, my needs. And if we stop at the thrills and pleasures of romance and don't expand our generosity, we will see our love disintegrate and possibly turn grotesque and ugly. In other words, falling in love can become a falling away from love because the feelings of romance sociologically and psychologically last between 18 months and 3 years, and then they peter out. We fall out of love within 3 years of falling in love. This is a pretty much of a given.
Hold that thought right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening, Bruce Brander, his book, A Love That Works. And, of course, he points out that in the Greek language, there were three terms for love. There was eros and philo, and then there was agape type of love. And the eros love was a romantic love that wasn't necessarily sexual, but it was a romantic love. But romantic love is something that maybe lasts a year, a couple of years at the most. And then, of course, the philo love. And why don't you pick up the story there now that the people have rejoined us?
Yeah, there's this love. It came from the word philo or dear, which is a Greek word for dear. It's a philia, is the kind of love that they refer to. And we've got words, Philadelphia, a city of brotherly love, you know. And philanthropy comes from that word. In other words, a generosity, a giving, a serving. And this is a kind of love that, unlike romance, which says, I want, I need, therefore I love, the secondary love, the higher love, is a we-centered love. Not me-centered, but we-centered. Where we begin to care about someone else without immediate reference to ourselves. And we seek to aid another person's welfare as well as our own. And it's a deep, warm, enduring devotion that develops into that, of people who relish one another's company and eagerly hope and help each other to live well. And sociologists tell us that most wedded couples whose marriages endure have succeeded in moving from romance up to this next level of love. It's this we-centered relationship. There's, before I left Geographic, I'm just trying to think of, I did a story on the Kalahari Bushmen of the Southern African, is the desert region, and there is a lady there named Nisa, and she was from the, I'll try to pronounce it as they do, the Kung tribe, Bushmen.
that clicking, you know, that, I haven't heard that. That's the way the causes talk, too, in South Africa, with that clicking
yes,
sound.
Yes, they have a click sound in their language. And she was from the Kung tribe in the African Kalahari Desert. And she experienced the same thing that many modern people experience when their marriages endure. She described the progression from eros love or romance love to this next level of, this higher level of love, this we-centered love that the Greeks called philia. We might call it camaraderie. That's the only word I can think of in English, because we don't have it much in our culture at the present time. But she said, and I quote here, when two people are first together, their hearts are on fire and their passion is very great. After a while, the fire cools, and that's how it stays. They continue to love each other, but it's in a different way, warm and dependable. And that's the kind of love that, this philia love, that it's not friendship on the shallow level that we think of. It's a very deep, committed devotion to one another's welfare, where if I'm loving my wife in that way, I'm seeking her happiness, I'm seeking her betterment as a person, and if she's loving me that way, she's doing the same thing. And it has nothing to do with the uncertainty and the excitement and the hopes and the letdowns of romance. It's got nothing to do with that at all. And where we make a mistake in our society, I think, is in trying to keep romance alive in marriage, where really we should be striving for this giving, sort of serving love, instead of just a grabbing, snatching love that makes us feel good.
Well, you know, when you speak of the Bushmen, I lived in South Africa for a time, and I remember we had a Bushman live next door to us. He really couldn't survive in society. He was an alcoholic, and he used to get drunk in the middle of the night and go swimming in our neighbor's pool singing hymns. But it was out, I'm sure, when he was living out there in the desert, and the desert is just so barren, you know. There's just no trees, there's a few little bushes, and yet the Bushmen can live there and can prosper, and they've done that for already thousands of years.
It's really astounding. It's like the I wrote a book on Australia for National Geographic, a hardcover book, and it's quite astounding what the Aborigines could do out there in country where we would be dead within 3 days. They could be just fine.
Yeah, and they can't survive in our society. We can't survive in theirs, at least not well without their help. And yet, of course, these people are able to establish relationships with their wives, that last for a lifetime.
Well, really, the patterns of love are the same from culture to culture. Romance occurs, there were two psychologists who found romance occurs in 142 out of 168 cultures, there is some indication of romantic attachment. So it occurs, it's not just Western, it occurs almost everywhere. And this higher kind of love does too, of course. And even among the Bushmen, who we think of as a primitive people, they have the same higher forms of love that we do. And perhaps they practice them even more often than we do right now.
Well, of course, maybe their marriages last a lot better than here in this civilized Western civilization.
Yes,
or so-called civilized Western civilization. Well, we'll be back here in just a moment. Our guest this evening, Bruce Brander, and we're talking about Love the Works. And a book I recommend to every single one of you, you ought to get it, to give it to your wife or husband for a Christmas present. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, Bruce Brander, his book, Love That Works. Our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295 if you're here in the Central Coast of California. But, you know, it's nice to read a book. When you get done reading it, you feel good about what you've read. And you feel that maybe it's just had an impact on you. Maybe you look at the world just a little bit differently than you did before you read the book. But love has been around since the beginning of civilization, but not necessarily the sort of love that's practiced in America today, because as Bruce points out so well, our system is not working, our society is not working, our marriages are ending in divorce and tragedy and bitterness, and then the terrible, terrible impact on the child. I mean, that is the real, the greatest tragedy of any divorce, is what it does to the child. So why don't you pick up the story? I don't know where you want to go for next, Bruce.
Well, just to recap a little bit, I tend to go rather hard on romance, and I don't mean to pan it all together. Some psychologists do. Eric Fromm was a very wise man. He was a psychoanalyst who wrote a wonderful book called The Art of Loving back in 1956. It's still in print. And he considered only altruistic love, only agape, to be worthy of the name love. And he considered our form of love a very debased, disintegrated, not love at all, but just disintegration of love. And Scott Peck, who many people remember from the book The Road Less Traveled, also thinks of love as altruism, and he doesn't really think of the sort of romantic love we practice as love at all. And yet it is. It is the form of love on a low level of emotional maturity. And it's... our romance says, I want, I need, therefore I love, and if you give me what I want and need, I'll dote on you, and if you don't, I'll hate you and throw a tantrum. And that I was talking to an interviewer in Los Angeles, and he said, that sounds like my first wife. But it's part of the course, you know. It's this love-hate relationship that is essentially a consumer-type love where I want her to meet my needs, and I'm drawing on her, I'm pulling on her, and grabbing at her, and it's really the relationship of a baby to the mother. And it's an infantile love, it's baby love. Do you remember that song, Baby Love, you know, and years ago, and just went on saying, baby love, baby love, baby love, and it's no coincidence that modern romancers call each other baby, because they're practicing an infantile kind of love. Whereas this next level of love that I mentioned in the book that is not well known today in our culture, that some people just sort of slip into and their marriages succeed, this philia love or camaraderie love.
Hold that thought for just a moment.
Sure.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and of course our guest this evening, Bruce Brander, his book, Love That Works, and really a very, very touching book, that the sort of book when you get done reading it, you say, I'm glad I read that book. Maybe I'm going to be a better person because of it. And of course, Bruce was talking about the various types of love. One of these is sort of baby love, a very, very selfish sort of love. And then pick up the story from there, Bruce.
Yes. We tend to practice this very babyish, selfish love that wants to suckle and feed on somebody. And since both partners are doing the same thing, they tend to drain each other, and then they have to break apart to recover. Whereas people who rise to the next level of love, which other times in history have regarded as a very fine level of love, being concerned for the other person's welfare, a we-centered love instead of a me-centered love, people who rise there find they're happy, they're content, they're comfortable with each other. They don't walk around all excited and thrilled like romance does. That wears out anyway. But they're it's a cozy kind of love. It's a very comfortable kind of love. And yet there's still a higher kind, which we see in people like Mother Teresa and Gandhi. And the Greeks called that agape. The Christian church calls it agape in the Bible frequently. And that was a pure giving love with no strings attached and no return expected. And we see it in people like Mother Teresa, and I mentioned that in Gandhi and Christ himself, and the Buddha did that when he found his happiness in Nirvana, but he came back to help other people. And all the great lovers in history have loved with this agape love, which many people think of as true love, as the highest form. Of course it is. And we see it commonly in the love of an emotionally healthy mother for her baby, which she gives to the baby with no regard for what that baby can do for her in return. And, you know, she gets up in the middle of the night and feeds the baby and changes his diapers, even though she doesn't want to, necessarily. And it's a giving, serving love dedicated to the welfare of the other person, of the highest welfare. And we religious people see it in God's love for his creation. And we all are capable of this. And if we aim high, we find ourselves growing emotionally. And I devote a portion of the book to the sickness of the sick society. A society is a group of people, so a sick society is by definition a group of sick people. And the sickness is emotional. We are led in our society to be very egotistical, very selfish, very concerned about number one, getting all the gusto and taking as much as we can get and things like that. And Eric Fromm, the psychoanalyst, points out that love relationships are just a more intense expression of the sort of relationships that prevail in a society. And in a dog-eat-dog society, we're going to have dog-eat-dog love. And this is what we have to break away from. And the message of this book is really simple. It's just be kind, be generous, don't grab and snatch. Love isn't out there somewhere. It isn't a consumer item. Love can be generated within ourselves. It's something we create, something we produce, something we give to other people in the form of generosity and kindness.
And I really think that, of course, is the key, is being really caring about the other person more than you care about yourself.
Yeah.
Because the problem is, I think we all have a tendency to be extremely selfish, and you know, but of course when we begin putting the other person's needs and wants ahead of ours, and they reciprocate, and even if they don't reciprocate, our obligation is to do the best that we can to make that love relationship work. Now, what about, of course, a religious belief? Does this, of course, foster a more permanent relationship?
Oh, yes, yes, indeed. Yeah, well, it's ironic, really, that Christian people who say they have that God is love and that their religion is a religion of love, they have the same troubles that the secular people do in our society with love and divorce. And there was one year where the divorce rate was even greater for Christians than for secular people, which I think was a fluke, but nonetheless it's ironic. And they follow, it seems, the society more than they follow their church, because their church teaches that love is generosity, is giving, is serving. And Paul the Apostle says that, and Christ himself says, love one another as I have loved you, and not as the world loves. And as the world loved then, was pretty much as the world loves now, the word romance comes essentially from it means love in the Roman manner. And in the late days of ancient Rome, they did have the kind of love we have now, very impermanent, very casual, high divorce rate, high adultery rate, and a lot of unhappiness. And that was the kind of love that they practiced in late Rome, and that's why we call our love after that. Romance is love in the Roman manner.
But of course the tragedy is that because the family broke down, because people became totally disillusioned with everything, why, when it came time to fighting for Rome, nobody wanted to fight for it. The society just sort of imploded from within.
Well, it was a very disheartened, very discouraged society all the way around, and people were very lonesome, and they didn't have a good family life, and the population went way down, as early as Augustus, in the days of even slightly before Jesus, the Roman Empire was passing laws to try to keep the family together and to raise the population. Now, President Bush is doing pretty much the same thing, passing government measures to try to keep the family together and try to curb the disintegration of the core of our society, which is the family. Confucius made a statement. He said that when there is peace in the home, there is peace in the kingdom. And when there's love in the home, there's peace in the kingdom. I correct myself there. When there's love in the home, there's peace in the kingdom. Because contented people, happy people, healthy, strong people who are emotionally strong as well as physically, they produce a serene, good, beneficial society. And that's what we're losing in our society. We've lost this kindness, this generosity, and it's become much, much too predatory.
Well, I remember a very wise man, minister, who really taught me most of what I know. They used to come down to the hospital every Tuesday or Thursday morning for, I think, 9 years and meet with just a handful of doctors just to pass on to us his knowledge and his wisdom. But I remember him saying that, you know, if you're having trouble with your wife, the problem isn't with your wife, the problem is your relationship to God. And if you have a good relationship to God, you're not going to have a problem with your wife, and your wife's not going to have a problem with you. But, of course, when yet that relationship is broken, then, of course, the strife comes into the family. And we can talk all we want to about the Christian America, but I think by your fruits shall you know them. And as I look and see what's happening in Christian America today, I wonder if this is really what is blessed by God.
And it's not just Christianity. I speak in this book to secular people as well. It was written for essentially everybody, not just Christians. And I was mistaken one time when I was giving a public talk, I was mistaken for a preacher, because the essence of the book is that generosity is love, is the higher form of love. Romance is love to acquire, acquisition love is one form of it. It's a low level of love. But the higher levels are generous, are giving, are serving, are honest and decent. And I was saying this, and somebody thought I was a preacher, and I'm not. I'm a journalist. And I simply have gathered a lot of facts, and these are the facts.
Well, I think when you come up, you put all the facts together, you come up with a pretty logical explanation for what's wrong with society. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Our guest this evening is Bruce Brander, and his book is Love That Works, of the Art and Science of Giving. And that's really what it's all about, is that in a relationship with somebody else, it's not a matter of going halfway. You've got to go all the way and hope that they will do as well and reciprocate.
Yeah, I thought of a quote here that I mentioned in the book. Kurt Vonnegut, who is the humorist, said in one of his books, "Please, a little less love and a little more common decency." And he was, of course, referring to the type of romantic love that's giving so many people so much pain, and he felt that it wasn't even decent. But one of the interesting things I found is the need for the higher levels of love. We actually do need it, not just to feel good, but just to stay alive properly. I went to Romania on assignment after the dictator Ceausescu fell, and the media discovered the orphanages in that country that were filled with unwanted children, gypsies, some children with physical defects, children that just nobody had the room in their house for, didn't want anymore, so they clapped them in these dreadful orphanages where they lived in dormitory rooms in barred cribs. Each child had a steel barred crib and never left it. They received very, very little attention from under-trained staff. They were fed, they were given a blanket, they were diapered, and that was about it. And these kids were never picked up and never held, never sung to, never rocked, never told stories. And there were children there who were 3 and 4 years old who still were the size physically of infants. They couldn't sit up, they couldn't talk, they couldn't walk. They just had not grown. And there's a word for this sickness. It's called marasmus, or failure to thrive. And the reason they had not grown was not because they weren't fed, they were, but because they weren't fed emotionally. And it seems that emotional feeding is absolutely necessary, that is altruistic, kind, generous love is necessary for small children to grow at all. And these kids, one of my colleagues, journalistic colleagues, adopted a little girl named Elena from one of these orphanages, and she's probably into her teens right now, but she's been having emotional problems ever since. Lovely little girl, very smart, but she'll probably never get over the emotional deprivation of those years. And in later, about, 10 years ago, I went to Rwanda. They had a terrible massacre there, you recall, the genocide, where some 800,000 people were slaughtered in a matter of 55 days, I think it was. And we came in the aftermath. I worked for World Vision Relief Agency, and we were gathering up lost children and orphans who had been, many of whom had been attacked, and the tribal people had tried to kill them with machetes, and they survived. And there was one little boy who we found. He was lying in a pile of corpses, actually, and we brought him out and brought him to an orphanage, and he couldn't talk at first. He was so stunned. He was so traumatized. But when he could speak, we said, "Well, what's your name?" And he said, "I am nobody's nothing." And it was obvious that people need altruism, need love, generous giving love, just these kids just for their identity. I mean, he was nobody's nothing. That was his image of himself. And there's a doctor named Dean Ornish. In this country, he's one of the most prominent doctors in the field of heart medicine, and he recites in a book called Love and Survival many, many studies that indicate that grown-up people, adults who we think of as independent, have a higher death rate if they live alone, a much higher sickness rate, much higher death rate from heart troubles and all other troubles, and people who live in community, in families, or in church communities, or other communal type living, and you know, who are connected, in other words.
Oh, we even hear that people who have an animal, you know, something to love, you know, older people are really so much happier.
That's exactly, and they're not looking for somebody to love them. They need somebody to love, somebody right. to give to serve, to help, and. That's why cats are so popular among women, you know, solitary women. They need something that will absorb a lot of attention, a lot of love. Yes, you're quite right that if they have animals, they do much better than if they live alone. But we do need love, we do, and I don't mean romance. We don't need more of that stuff. But we do need altruism, not only receiving it, but giving it. Even more important is to give it.
Right, and of course it's really something that people don't really stop and think about, not in our fast-paced society, and certainly when we see what we see on television, and we're told this is love, and of course it's not love at all, you know, it's sort of like rotating bedrooms, and I really believe that the effect of television upon our society, and eroding the moral foundation of our society, and giving people a really false approach to what love is really all about. And I really think that you, of course, in your book, it's a short little book, but of course I think it has a profound impact. What sort of response are you getting as you're talking to people across America about it?
Well, I'm getting a very good response. I understand that Barnes & Noble was sold out within 10 days of the book's release a couple months ago, and on Amazon.com, I was looking for a book on Amazon with I tuned in my own book to see how it was doing, and they said they're down to 5 copies and they've reordered. So I guess it's doing well. We won't know for a while yet because it's quite a new book. But I found that a lot of people are buying the book and then giving it to other people. They read it themselves, and then they buy copies for their kids and for their girlfriends and for other people. They see it, as I see it too, as a practical guide, as you put it, a manual to more successful love. And it is. I sure wish I'd had it when I was 23 years old or 22 years old. I think I'd have done a whole lot better and had a much happier life at that time. I do have a happy life now with 4 really nice kids, but it took a while.
Right. Well, of course, we get older and smarter, and at least we get older and we hope we get smarter. Anyway, of course, I think it's a very important book, and this one reason why we're carrying it is just because we think it's something that it would be a very, very important thing for every family to have, every family that has children, and of course to read something like this, that will give you an entirely different view of what's going on than what you're going to get from contemporary society, because contemporary society is obviously failing. So what can we learn from ages past? And of course, there's nothing new under the sun. All of these things can be dated back to what happened in ancient Greece and what happened in ancient Rome, and of course, what happened in what we would refer to as primitive and tribal societies. But they had relationships, whether they were married in the sight of God, they had relationships that lasted forever. I mean, there are certain birds that mate forever, and one dies, why, they never remarry. I mean, it's inherent with all of us to have that mate with us, and of course, hopefully to stay with that same mate for life. But unfortunately, America is not succeeding, and so what's wrong? Well, I think anybody who gets the book Love That Works will find certainly there are lots of answers here and things, information that you need to have, but I think specifically for our younger people. Although I think even this older folks can certainly learn a great deal from this. Have you had any criticism at all of the book?
Yes, I did. I had only one. I sent the book out to a lot of scholars before I released it, because I'm a journalist and not a theologian or a psychologist. And I sent it out to a lot of scholars, and there was a feminist scholar of great renown who was irritated that I didn't have more about feminism in it. And I don't know, that's not my field.
Well, I don't know what that has to do with feminism. It has to do with men and women together. It has nothing to do with men specifically or women specifically, but the relationship between the two of them. So, you know, I think that, see, maybe she just has a hang-up. I think there's some women who do. And there's just, usually, of course, there are women who hate men, and they don't understand. They've probably never been in a truly loving relationship themselves, which is why they're feminists.
Well, we exchanged messages for a while and became good friends, actually.
Okay, we'll be back in just a moment here to wrap up this evening's program. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening, Bruce Brander. We've been talking about his book, Love That Works, and Bruce has had a fascinating life, traveled throughout the world, and worked for National Geographic, and written books, and of course has seen the best of the world and the worst of the world, and the horror of, of war-torn of regions. He's been there, but now, of course, he's back at home with his family and writing, and he's taken on this job of writing a book, a simple book, and yet a very, very profound book. About love, a love that works, and how each one of us really needs to ask what we want from love. Do we want the Eros type of love? Do we want the Philo type of love? Do we want the Agape type of love? Because the Agape type of love is what really accomplishes something, not only for ourselves, for our partner, but for society as a whole. Well, we've got about 2 minutes to wrap up the program. What was your parting thoughts be for our listeners this evening, Bruce?
Well, the parting advice from the book that emerges from the book is simply that we should aim high. We should aim to this agape or unconditional love, some psychologists are calling it. And if we do that, the more we do it, the easier it becomes, the more we grow emotionally, and the sickness of the sick society has gotten into us, is forced out. We become healthier, stronger, more independent people, more content, more comfortable. And if we aim high in this kind of love, not only in our families, but in the whole world, in our supermarket lines and everywhere we go, our whole relationship to life can become this high-level unconditional love, and we grow and grow and grow and find ourselves much, much happier people, much less needy people, and much more successful.
Well, I think that's certainly an excellent analysis of this. And, of course, love is an integral part of our life, integral part of what we do. And if we can love, why, we're going to be lots happier people. And, of course, the people who come in contact us will be happier as well. But, Bruce, I want to thank you so very much for being with us. And it's really always a pleasure. I wish we could get that other book of yours back in print, but maybe someday.
Well, the publisher has considered reprinting it. They had a bad year financially last year, so they didn't do it, but they might reprint it.
Well, I hope they will. It's called Staring into Chaos, and if you it does get them back in print, why, we'll get Bruce back on it just to discuss that, because one only has to look at the history of past civilizations and then look and see what's happening in America today to know exactly where we're going, and I think the title is very apropos, because I fear, as I look and see what's going on around us in America, once the beacon of light, the hope of the world, and now is staring into chaos. Good night and God bless you. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, that's Stan.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and of course, if you're interested in getting the book or learning more about it, well, you can give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. The book is Love That Works, The Art and Science of Giving. Really a beautifully written book, and a real pleasure to read and to discuss with Bruce. And although I've never met him, I've talked to him many times on this and his other book, and so we really feel that we know him. And anyway, we want to also mention that Radio Liberty, my ministry, is primarily listener-supported, and if you're out there listening to us and you believe that the material you learn here is perhaps a little different than you're going to get elsewhere, we hope many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters, and you do that by simply calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Now, if you'd like to, of course, get a free copy of our newsletter, our October newsletter, it's a very interesting newsletter. It goes into the background of a secret society that was sent to America in 1640 by Sir Francis Bacon, who was one of the truly Machiavellian characters of history. He was involved with the Rosicrucianism, which is a Luciferian organization, and he sent a secret society to the United States in 1640 to take care over control of this country. And of course, we simply don't tell you what I think about it. We tell you what the people who are on the other side, who come from the other dimension, who are basically deeply involved in the occult, say about this secret society and its impact on America today. And only by understanding that can you really understand why America is in the process of simply imploding from within, why we are at war over in the Middle East and where that war is going to lead, why America's economy is being destroyed from within, why our leaders are doing everything they can to destroy the value of our currency and impoverish our people, to subsidizing Chinese companies, in other words, not American companies moving over to China, but subsidizing Chinese companies that are undercutting and destroying the industries here in America. It doesn't make sense unless you understand the spiritual nature of the battle we're engaged in, and the fact that there's no incident in all history where a nation is turned against God, where God is not eventually turned against that nation. So if you'd like to get a copy of our October newsletter, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, we hope that many of you out there will go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com, where you can hear our programs 5 hours a day, either on that website or in the various links to the other networks we do, starting at 7 in the morning and going until 10 o'clock at night. So you can listen to our programs somewhere in America every day, 5 hours a day, certainly 5 hours a day on the Internet, 5 hours a day on satellite, and 4 hours a day on the shortwave. And many people, I'm sure, are listening across America today. So then, of course, we hope that many of you will look at some of the items we carry. We carry the Big Berkey and Berkey Light products. We think that they are something every family should have, certainly at times like this when we actually face a very, very real possibility of disruption of our society or a chemical or biological attack. And you know, what happens when you go to the faucet and the water doesn't work? Come on. Or what happens if you had to get water out of a creek? Well, this is why you need a big Berkey. Of course, a lot of people like the Berkey water filter simply because they like the taste of the water. So we would hope that if you're interested in the big Berkey water filters or interested in the Robinson homeschool curriculum or a good shortwave radio for yourself or for someone in your family so they can listen to Radio Liberty, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. You can learn about more of them up there on the web at radioliberty.com. So at this point, we ask you to pray for America, to pray for revival, but please pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Until tomorrow, may the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. But we ask you to hold your calls for the moment. Hopefully we're going to have John Spring on the line here in just a moment. And John, of course, is a geographer, is a frequent guest here on Radio Liberty. And certainly we have had him on many, many times in the past. And we like to talk about what's going on in the world, what's going on in the Middle East. And hopefully John's going to be here. And there he is. Came on the line just this moment. Hi, John. How are you doing?
Real fine, Dr. Stan. I heard you on shortwave just before the call came in. You're coming in loud and clear.
Oh, good. Well, I'm glad to know. Which are you looking at? That 7.535 or the other one?
I think it's 7.35, almost near the 8 meter band.
All right, right. That would be 7.535 then, because the other was 558. So anyway, John, of course, does his own talk show program in Southern California and has an opportunity to reach the people there. And certainly, is that the Inland Empire where you're broadcasting?
Yes, that's our main area and Southern Orange County.
All right, well, that's certainly a good conservative area, and got a pretty good time there on Sunday afternoon. We did the program with John this last this last weekend. Anyway,
it was a pleasure having you on.
There's so many things that are going on today.
Yes.
And of course, the average American really doesn't like to think about what's happening. They know something has to be wrong. I mean, how could the mightiest nation in the world, I mean, go in and make such a mess out of the situation in Iraq? I mean, what a wonderful victory we had in just a very few days while we'd taken Baghdad. And then suddenly, the American officials go in and they disband the Iraqi army, and they disband the Iraqi police force, and they fire everybody, the fellow who runs the water plant, the people who run the electric plant, the people who have the sewers, the people who have the civil service, and then we have a chaotic situation. Everybody said, gee, why do we have chaos here? And now we've got all these people in the military who'd been promised would drop leaflets saying, we're not going to disband the army, we're not going to disband the police force, all we want to do is get rid of Saddam Hussein, lay down your weapons, don't fight us, you know, we're not here to occupy your country. And of course, they finally realized the Americans have lied. The Americans are there to occupy the country. When they allow terrible, chaos to develop. There's a looting of the museums. These museums of things, artifacts that are 3 or 4 or 5 thousand years old. The Americans are over there guarding the oil ministry, but leaving the museums and the rest of the country open to chaos. And everybody's saying, well, maybe they lied to us. And what we've done is we've lost the support of the people of Iraq. How could you do such a poor job unintentionally? Have you ever asked that, John?
Well, I've been very concerned about the situation, and yes, Dr. Stan, I have asked that question time over time, because not only is this true in Afghanistan, but also now in Iraq, and unfortunately, most of the American people don't have even a clue as to how miserable things are over there. I spoke with Joyce Riley recently, and she said the morale of our troops is so low. There's been so many suicides that have gone unreported.
Hold that thought right there, John. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is John Spring, and we're talking really about what's going on over in the Middle East. You know, it was very interesting. It's yesterday, those of you who are watching your television will remember that Donald Rumsfeld had taken a trip over to Iraq, and of course he made the mistake of opening up the discussion for questions from the audience. And
yes.
Unlike the president, who always insists knowing what the questions are so that he can have the answer already out for him by Dick Cheney or by somebody else, and he always, I don't know if you've watched the president's press conferences, but he doesn't look at the audience and ask a call upon one of the reporters. He looks down at the podium in front of him to see the name of the reporter he's supposed to call on next. Then he looks up and says, George, do you have a question for me? And George gets up, and you'll see he's got the question all written out on a little pad of paper. He asks the questions he's supposed to ask. The president looks down, reads the reply, and of course, then we go on to the next question. And that works really well, unless the president is foolish enough to ask, does anybody else have a question, and he doesn't know what the question is going to be. And the last time I saw that, and he didn't know the answer, and he said, gee, I wish you'd written that out ahead of time so I would have known the answer. But anyway, those of us saw Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld's press interview yesterday, one of the sergeants got up and said, why is it that we have to go into the junkyards, and dig up, the metal so that we can have armored personnel carriers, so we can do something to protect our personnel carriers? Why don't we have adequate equipment? And, why are not our vehicles armored? And, of course, Rumsfeld said, could you repeat that question? I didn't understand it. Of course, he was really trying to think of an answer. But we have sent our boys over there inadequately armed. Many of them don't have body armor, with vehicles that are not prepared for what's going on today. They do not have armor on them. And, what are we? We're a year into this, and, we're going to get to the supplies one of these days. and more boys die. And I really believe that the morale is very low, because I think a lot of the boys over there, although you're not going to see them on television, are saying, why are we here? An awful lot of them are being held there against their will. They signed up for a specific term. Their term has expired, and they're being forced to stay. It's an involuntary draft. People are being called up in this country who have been out of the military for 20 years. People 50, 55 years of age who haven't held a rifle in 20 years are being called up. This is all part of a draft, but we don't call it a draft. We call it just normal military service. We'll be right back here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, our guest this evening is John Springer. We're just talking about the real problem with the morale of the men over in the Middle East. And certainly it was just yesterday when Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, was over there, and a sergeant got up. And of course, I'm sure he probably is no longer a sergeant, but he asked the Secretary of Defense, why is it that we have to go out and dig in junkyards and try to dig up some armor to put on our vehicles to protect ourselves with it? Why don't we have proper equipment? And everybody in the audience broke into applause. Now, you only saw that one time, and then after that, they blacked that out. Did you notice that, John?
Yes, I did, Dr. Stan. And I think Rumsfeld was rather red in the face at the time because he did not expect a question of that type, and yet it was a very legitimate question. And I think everyone in that room felt the same way that brave sergeant who asked the question felt.
You mean that probably that private today has probably been demoted. You're not supposed to question what goes on. You're supposed to just be a stupid, dumb animal. That's what Henry Kissinger calls our fighting men, stupid, dumb animals. And you're supposed to be a stupid, dumb animal and never question people in authority. And what was Rumsfeld's response? Would he go to war with the army that you've got, not the army that you'd like to have? Well, yes. If you don't have an army that has the equipment it needs to protect itself and protect the lives of our people, we shouldn't be there, because Saddam Hussein was not a threat to the United States. And Donald Rumsfeld was part of the little project, the New American Clique, that intentionally got us into war with Iraq. This has nothing to do with the war on terrorism.
Absolutely.
If you read the book, The Price of Loyalty by Paul O'Neill, that's The Price of Loyalty by Paul O'Neill, and I think it's page 96. O'Neill talks about, he's the Secretary of the Treasury, he's just become, taken control of the White House, he's part of the new Bush administration. He goes to the first meeting of the National Security Council in January or February of 2001, 7 to 8 months before the 9/11 attack, and there's Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney and Paul Wolfowitz saying, how are we going to get to war with Iraq? How are we going to divide up the oil in Iraq? How are we going to justify a preemptive strike in Iraq? And O'Neill is saying, what does this have to do with anything? Why are they talking about going to war with Iraq? You know, and so we're in Iraq having nothing to do with Osama bin Laden. We never tried to get Osama bin Laden. We're not in Iraq having anything to do with the weapons of mass destruction, because we get sold Saddam Hussein those terrible weapons of mass destruction, that evil, evil man. And he was an evil man, and he was subsidized by your tax dollars to the tune of about $10 billion during the 1980s, right up until the first Gulf War. And then, of course, after the first Gulf War, why the United States government allowed him to smuggle oil. Every time that the Iraqi military tried to overthrow him, why we betrayed the Iraqi military, because they contacted us to let us know what was going on, and then the State Department betrayed those people, and they were arrested, tortured, and killed. And that's covered in a book called See No Evil by Robert Baer, which we carry still.
An excellent book, by the way.
Right. Well, so anyway, John, you know, as we see what's going on over there, the average American has been lied to repeatedly. When are they going to realize that they cannot trust their government, that in war the first casualty is the truth?
Yes, it has been the truth, very definitely, Dr. Stan. What bothers me about the present situation is that I see no end to the current situation in the Middle East on the part of the U.S. I don't see any possible date of leaving in the foreseeable future, returning any of our troops or all of our troops to the United States. It seems as if we are committed to be there indefinitely, which would be well beyond your lifespan or my lifespan. And this bothers me because eventually this is going to affect practically every American in the United States.
It's going to destroy the value of our currency. I mean, one reason our currency is tumbling is because of our massive deficit. And, of course, that deficit is largely fueled by this foolish and ill-conceived war.
Yes. And it seems as if our education system here in the United States is designed primarily just to promote cannon fodder for our armies to fight in these wars overseas. Our education system is in dismal condition right now, and I don't see any improvement. I just see a further decline in our educational system. I was giving a lot of thought tonight in terms of how our education system has gone to such a low standard within a relatively short period of time, just within a few decades, basically, to a point where essentially no substantial learning is really taking place anymore. And I would just hope and pray that we could turn the learning system around in the United States so that, again, we will be turning out scholars and citizens who are intelligent enough to make decisions so that they can intelligently elect officials who will do the best job.
Well, let me suggest something. Most people, John, think that our educational system is a failure because we don't spend enough money, because the class size is too large. Well, then, of course, you take the next step and you say, well, they're not teaching our kids the right things. You know, they know, as I've said so many times, more about sex than they do about Shakespeare, certainly more about Marilyn Monroe than they know about mathematics. They're not being taught to read with phonics. And I believe those things are all true. But I think there is another factor. And that is that 67% of our communities have been fluoridated, and we know from studies in other countries that you drop about 10 points in IQ when, of course, you fluoridate the water. So that means that the average in America, the average IQ is no longer 10% in fluoridated areas, is 100%. It's now 90% because they've lost 10 points of their IQ and compared with the rest of the world. And this is one reason that nobody ever wants to talk about. And yet, of course, anybody who gets my latest newsletter, the November newsletter, and, of course, gets the syllabuses and the other information we'll have available, knows that we are intentionally destroying the minds of our children. So it may be, John, that we'll be incapable of turning out the children who can think and reason and compete with the Indians and the Chinese, because there's been an organized effort to destroy the mental capacity of our children. And you can go back and you can read what Bertrand Russell talked about in 1953 in his book, The Impact of Science on Society, where he talked about how diet and injections and injunctions would be used to shape the character of our children so they'd be unable to think independently.
Yes, and as you pointed out so well on one of your programs that was aired here, I think just this last Saturday in Southern California, Donald Rumsfeld had some other rather devious roles. The first one was promoting aspartame, which the FDA and the beverage industry would not ethically ever accept as a substitute for sugar. But, of course, he was able to influence enough of the officials back there where he was fairly well established in Washington, and such products as Equal and NutraSweet are trade names for aspartame, which also has very negative effects on the mind and body.
It sure does, and I think that we're being poisoned by many things that are being done today intentionally to destroy the minds of our children. Who could be that wicked and evil? Well, one of them might be Donald Rumsfeld, and the other would be the people pushing fluoridation. They know its impact, and the other people would be the ones who, right today, public health officials are saying, oh, got to get your child down. We're just about out of vaccine shots, but you maybe get it down. If your child is 6 months of age, we'll see they get them, knowing full well that there's mercury in there that will destroy the minds of our children. You got to be awfully evil to do that, but I believe there is evil in the world today.
Yes, but I'm pleased to see that a lot of people basically on the street are now becoming aware of the danger of the flu vaccine. They're aware of the contamination from mercury and other products that are in these vaccinations. So I think there's hope. But you know, there's another evil thing that you pointed out about Donald Rumsfeld, which I don't think we should overlook, and that is that he, well, I don't think I need to use the word allegedly, but he was involved with the selling of chemical reagents to Saddam Hussein prior to the war between Iraq and Iran, and those chemical reagents were used against Iranian soldiers and Kurdish villagers.
And I think it was probably during the war, because the yes. war started in 1980 or 81, and he was over there in 83, but you're absolutely right.
Yes.
Donald Rumsfeld, of course, was the American, or not ambassador, but he was sort of assigned to go over there. And we sold Saddam, the wicked Saddam Hussein, the chemical agents, and we continued to support him after. He used it on the Kurds, after he used it on the Iranians. How can you justify something like that unless you yourself are terribly evil?
Yes.
And as evil as Saddam Hussein is, and I would never defend him, but how can the Christians of America, the good people of America, defend government officials who would back Saddam Hussein after he'd used the chemical weapons to do these terrible things? And why don't we ever talk about that here in America?
Well, I think the reason we don't talk about it is because very few of us are aware of it, and the rest of the people would just as soon not be informed. They would rather be watching Monday Night Football with their six-pack, and unfortunately, our ignorance about these situations is going to come back to haunt us, Dr. Stan.
Men and women become accomplices to the evils they fail to oppose.
Absolutely.
And as Dottie assured us, Dottie who wrote The Inferno, you know, the hottest places in hell are reserved for those who in a time of moral crisis maintain a position of neutrality. And I don't believe there's ever been a time in history where there's more of a moral crisis than there is today. Well, if you'd like to give us a call, our telephone number 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. We'd love to hear from you. That's our guest this evening, John Spring, and of course, our topic, well, we're sort of just talking about what's going on in the Middle East and the crisis we face not only there, but the moral crisis we face in America. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, John Spring, who has his own radio program. John, would you like to tell our listeners a little bit about your radio program and how they can hear it and how they can get in touch with you if they'd like to?
Yes. Our radio program can be heard in certain areas of Southern California on AM 1510, which is KSPA or KSPA, the Station of the Stars. But you can also hear it throughout the nation and the world, for that matter, on the internet at www.crusaderadio.com every Sunday afternoon at 4 p.m. Pacific Standard Time until 5 p.m. And we welcome your calls, just as Dr. Stan welcomes calls on his program. And we try to have outstanding guests, and we certainly did last Sunday when we had Dr. Stan as our special guest. And I try to get some of the same guests that Dr. Stan does, and sometimes I get different guests. And my guests are not always conservative. Sometimes they're liberal, but generally speaking, they're probably a little bit more to the right than they are to the left, by and large. But what I'm looking for is truth rather than indoctrination. I don't want to indoctrinate people or convince them that my philosophy or politics might be superior to theirs, but rather we're looking for truth together.
So it reminds me, I got a call this evening from a gentleman who listens to my program, and then he listens to Bertie Ward and Ray Taliaferro up in KGO in San Francisco.
Yes.
And he said, boy, he says, you know, you fellas are just all on the right side. And of course, Bertie Ward is as far to the left as he possibly can be, and Ray Taliaferro is even a little further to the left. But at least as far as what's going on in the Middle East, the war over there, they're absolutely telling the truth. And, you know, the tragedy is today, John, we live in a world gone mad where I find many times the Christian right, the Christian conservative, are blindly following along behind the administration, just like the German people followed along behind their administration in the 1930s and cheered for the successes there, their Wehrmacht, as they overrode country after country. They could not believe that their leader, who they believed was a Christian, this great leader who was giving them hope and of getting back, to giving Germany pride again, they couldn't believe that he was the evil man and monster that he was. And yet, here, the only people who are speaking out about what's going on here in the United States today are people on the radical left. But if they are saying what's true, and when they bring out what's true, I have to applaud them for it. And I'm even having we'll have somebody on later this week who I would consider extremely liberal on most issues. But as far as what happened on 9/11, as far as the war is concerned, as far as what the administration, the current administration, is doing, he's absolutely right. And I think that we have to agree where we can agree and disagree when we can't agree. But certainly, if just because somebody's on the left, if what they say is true, I want to applaud them and support them in every way on that issue.
Absolutely. I agree with you completely on that, Dr. Stan. If I may go back to Iraq for a moment, I would just like to mention that I've had an opportunity to discuss this situation with some of my friends of Arab ancestry, some of whom were of Kurdish and Jordanian descent, and are fairly familiar through their own contacts and their ability to read and speak and listen to the Arabic language.
Hold that thought there for just a moment here, and as we regain our rest of our stations. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess this evening, John Spring. Our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And John is saying that he's had an opportunity to actually talk to some friends of his of Kurdish extraction or Jordanian extraction. These are people who are fluent in the language, know the situation. And so what are they telling you about what's going on over there?
Well, they are very disturbed. They love America, Dr. Stan, just as much as you and I do, basically. They're very patriotic people. But at the same time, they're very disturbed by our policy with respect to Iraq and some of the other neighboring nations as well, because we supposedly went over there to liberate Iraq, and as you mentioned earlier in the program, we are occupying that nation. And the people have become, in a rather short period of time, rather xenophobic towards us. Many of the so-called terrorists that we are fighting in places like Fallujah are not really the terrorists in terms of being organized or trained as such, but rather they are people that have just lost faith with the American ethic of occupation. They don't trust the Americans anymore. They feel out of desperation that they must resist. And it's a very tragic situation. We have not used the best public relations policies over there. You can recall even more than a year ago, in order to get information from some of the local farmers about so-called insurgents or terrorists not too far away from their farms, if they felt fearful or were reluctant to provide information, some of the U.S. soldiers would be ordered to plow down their fields or take a bulldozer and plow down their date palms, which have been in existence at those spots for hundreds of years. Our lack of respect for property, stolen cars, in many cases stolen taxis that were taken over by terrorists for a brief period of time, rather than being returned to the proper owners, those vehicles were demolished to set an example so that supposedly taxi cab drivers would not collaborate with a terrorist, when in reality they had no intention of collaborating with them in the first place. They were just the victims of circumstances. And justice being met out in such a manner is very unfortunate, because the word gets around that these Americans are not really the freedom seeking people, the liberators that we thought they were, but they are here to suppress us, and if we don't cooperate with them, we're going to end up in places like Abu Ghraib. And by the way, Dr. Stan, it appears that most of the interrogators at Abu Ghraib were Israelis. These were about the only personnel that we could recruit and supposedly trust who could speak and understand Arabic fluently. And as a result, there were a lot of atrocities committed which were not well monitored at all. And those that were monitored were apparently allowed to continue right up to the top of Donald Rumsfeld. For some reason, that name keeps repeating itself throughout.
Well, I think that the fact that the Christians in this country will tolerate a regime that is encouraging torture, and there's no question at all that they did. Of course, the president will deny it, and Rumsfeld will deny it, and the generals will deny it. But all of the evidence shows that we changed our policy. If we were all right to torture people, and you could torture anybody you want to, we were at war, we had to win. The ends justified the means, and we turned our back on the moral standards that once made America the envy of the world. We are not a brutal nation, but we've adopted brutal policies, and once we've adopted brutal policies and compromised our moral principles, then, of course, we've lost the respect of the rest of the world. And this did not happen accidentally. They knew exactly what they were doing. They allowed torture of the people in Guantanamo long before Abu Ghraib. And they allowed torture of the people in Afghanistan,
yes,
long before Abu Ghraib. And there was, before those the whole thing was blown up there at Abu Ghraib, they knew what was going on, and people who spoke out against it were threatened. We have articles going into that, if anybody wants to see them, months ahead of time. People from the Defense Intelligence Agency saw what was happening, and they were told that they could not speak about it, they could not leave the prison. They were not allowed, of course, to tell anybody what they'd seen. Now, don't tell me this was the few isolated instances. This was part of a program. America, of course, has turned its back on what's right, and of course has embraced what I believe is totally evil, and this is going to come back one day to haunt the American people. We'll be back here in just a moment. And, of course, we'll welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest this evening is John Spring. And, of course, John was saying that he's talked to people from Jordan and from certainly from Kurdistan, or people who know them, people there. And, of course, they're very disturbed at what's going on. Well, my understanding is that the Kurds, the area up in Kurdistan is fairly stable. And, of course, the Kurds are glad, at least for the time being, not to have to worry about Saddam Hussein. I think their major concern is what's going to happen when you have a one-man, one-vote situation. And, of course, they're brought under the control of the Shias, because the Shia Muslims make up 61% of the people. And if we have a true democracy in Iraq, why, of course, the Christians, 10% of the population, they've already fled. Oh, isn't it wonderful now? We've opened up Iraq for the Christianity. Well, the Christians over there, basically Christian sects that have been there, Assyrian Christians and Chaldeans, they've all fled the country. They know they have no future. And the Kurds, of course, the Sunni Muslims will be outvoted. Unless we stay there indefinitely, why, they will simply be overrun and oppressed by the Shia Muslims. What are your thoughts, John?
Well, you're correct along those lines. Apparently, we did not bother to do any study of the modern history of Iraq right after the end of the First World War, in which the British attempted to occupy that region, and they were able to do so, but at such a heavy price on British soldiers and deaths among Iraqi civilians was so high each year that the British came to their senses and said, we cannot perpetuate indefinitely this type of a policy, so they more or less set up a kingdom within Iraq and left as graciously as they could. We, on the other hand, have not bothered to study the history. We probably have studied the oil fields more intensely, but we have not bothered to study the history, even the modern history of Iraq, and we have very little understanding or respect for their culture, which is completely foreign to most Americans. And when you attempt to initiate a program out of ignorance, you're going to pay a dear price. And we are beginning to pay a very dear price, Dr. Stan.
But I think it wasn't that they didn't know. They knew exactly what they were doing. There's a book written called Imperial Hubris, written by supposedly anonymous. He was a CIA agent who said, we knew all of these things. We kept trying to tell them in the White House that we were laying ourselves open for terrible, terrible problems, that there was going to be resistance no matter what we did. And they totally ignored what they were told. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess this is John Spring. Our subject, really what's going on in the Middle East, and the fact that high government officials knew exactly what was going to happen. They've been told repeatedly by the CIA that when we went in there, we were opening up a can of worms, and there was no way we were going to be able to subdue the government. People there any more than the British have been able to subdue them, you know, going back to the period immediately after the First World War. You're talking about 1918, 1919, yep. 1920. They sent in one expeditionary force, and it was literally wiped out, and then they had to go in with a massive expeditionary force, and they could subdue the country, but they could never conquer the country. And as John Spring pointed out, eventually they had to, of course, create this unstable situation, combining three separate people. Instead of giving them their own countries, they wanted an unstable area. So they took the Kurds, part of the Kurdish nation, and then part of the Sunni Muslims, and then the Shia Muslims, and put them all together under a king or ruler that the British had appointed. Why? Because it did not want a stable nation there. They wanted this instability, and of course, it's been unstable ever since then. From one revolution, one dictator to another, from monarchy to a dictator to a military coup, back to a so-called a monarchy, and then, well, where we are today, a totally chaotic situation, intentionally and purposely created in 1918 and 1919, I believe, in preparation for times like these. Well, John, what are your friends, the people that you talk to who are acquainted with the situation over there, what is their feeling about what's happening, and what can we do about it?
Well, unfortunately, there are some very negative things happening here on the home front. I know of some Arab families who are planning to relocate back to Jordan because they are encountering so much harassment and hatred from Americans who have a tendency to place all Islamic peoples and Arabs in one category, which is essentially that they are terrorists and cannot be trusted. And they love this country very much, but because they're fearful for their young children, and they're very concerned about the moral decay in our society within our public school system, that they feel that it's better to return to the Middle East, where their children will have a more stable upbringing than they are getting here in the United States.
I'm sure they're not going to get a moral teaching here in the United States. If they absorb our culture, then they themselves will be destroyed.
Yes, and it's sad that good, decent people who love this country so much have to realistically start thinking in such terms. I know years ago we used to see a bumper sticker slogan which was essentially love it or leave it, but unfortunately when you have people hating you, you don't have much choice. Either you're going to face punishment and harassment, or you're going to look for a more secure a place to live, and in many instances we're going to see wonderful patriotic Americans of Arab ancestry returning to the Middle East because of how they are being treated by Americans who are ignorant of that part of the world and trying to place everyone in one category, and that is basically if they are not of European ancestry, they must be terrorists. It's very tragic.
I'm sure that it really is, and I'm sure that there are many good Muslim people living here in this country who would like to enjoy the freedoms of our society. Unfortunately, their leaders want to make this into a Muslim nation, and the average individual is just wants to live and be left alone. But there are people here who really believe that they can conquer us simply by absorption into this Muslim nation. And I've seen them working within the Republican Party. You know, they talk about being Republicans.
Yes.
They're not Republicans. They are dedicated to the political Islam. And this is how they're actually taking over Europe today. You know, two generations from today, Europe will be a Muslim nation. We are not a Muslim a continent unless something is done dramatically. And in the same way that we are losing our country because of open borders, so Europe is losing their country because of open borders. And because the Europeans are not having children, and the Muslims are having children, 5-6 children in their family, and that doesn't have to go for more than a generation or so, and then you've lost your country. And the people of Europe, of course, speak out against this, are attacked by the controlled media. The media is not controlled by the Muslims. The media is controlled by people who have an intense hatred of European and Western culture and want to destroy it. And they themselves are not Muslims, but they are part of this, what I refer to as the Brotherhood of Darkness.
Yes.
The same thing happens here in the United States. Anybody who talks about, illegal immigration, well, they don't call it illegal immigration. They call it undocumented immigrants. Undocumented immigrants, because illegal means that they've done something wrong. Undocumented simply means why they haven't been documented. And they use these word games, and this is being funded by the Ford Foundation, whose goal has always been the destruction of America, because that was Henry Ford's goal, and people don't understand that he was deeply involved in the occult, as were so many of his contemporaries. And until we understand the origins of these ideas, based upon the hatred of America, we can't understand anything going on in America today.
Yes, Dr. Sen. Now, what I find most disheartening about what is going on in the Middle East is that basically we are not providing new leadership that is really much healthier than what we supposedly are liberating the Afghans and the Iraqis from, basically. In Afghanistan, for all practical purposes, even though they've elected Hamid Karzai, a Marxist basically rules that nation. He's sort of the clandestine government over there, but his name is Muhammad Fahim, and he was one of those communists who led the coup against the constitutional monarchy back in 1978. And for some reason now he is Minister of Defense. He has his own private army, and he has far more control of that nation than Hamid Karzai will ever have as the supposedly first elected president of Afghanistan. And yet most Americans are completely unaware of this person or his background. They are not aware of the atrocities that were committed under his leadership of the Northern Alliance or Northern Front just months before we supposedly wiped out the Taliban. We're not aware of the atrocities, although they've been very well documented and videotaped and even shown on some of the PBS stations. And in the case of the country that we're currently occupying, Iraq, we seemingly are unaware of who the current acting president of Iraq really is.
Are you talking about Alawi?
Alawi, yes.
Right.
Dr. Alawi, allegedly just a few days before he took office, personally executed with a pistol a half a dozen young Iraqis who he alleged were insurgents right in the prison, took them out of their prison cells right into the prison courtyard and personally executed them himself.
But that's what the strong man does. That's what Saddam Hussein does in Alawi. The man we put in power wants to do exactly the same thing. I read that same story in the New American, and I have no reason to believe it's untrue, especially because the controlled media totally ignored the story. So, I mean, but that is what the way that the rulers have always ruled over there. And I in no way excuse it at all. What, of course, is inexcusable is the fact that we're backing this butcher.
Yes. Yes, indeed we are. Now, I cannot predict who the next leader of Iraq will be after these so-called elections occur, if they do occur the 1st of January, but I think we're going to, again, find somewhat of a Marxist government or a socialist government being brought into play, basically, and here in America, we will refer to it as a democratic regime, which is very favorable to the United States, not having a clue that this is diametrically opposed to everything that you and I here in America believe in.
But why should we be surprised? We brought Fidel Castro to power in 1959. We brought the Sandinista to power, you know, in 19, under Jimmy Carter, that was about 1978. We brought the Ayatollah to power in Iraq back in 1979. You know, why should we be surprised that we're bringing, you know, a Marxist regime to power in Iraq? And certainly, I don't know what we brought to power over there. And I suppose we brought the Marxists to power in Afghanistan as well. The country that is producing more drugs, more heroin than any other country in the world. 80% of the world's heroin comes from a country that's totally occupied by American troops, and we are guarding those opium fields for that for the warlords over there. We could wipe them out tomorrow. We will not do that. Under the Taliban, they cut off the production of heroin, and under the American-sponsored government that's in power today, while the fields are blooming, and of course the supplies are sweeping across the world.
Yes.
And you know, nobody in America says, why are we protecting the people who are growing all that opium? Unless you really understand that the CIA, and this is really a CIA operation in Afghanistan, the CIA has been promoting drug use and drug smuggling going back for almost for 50 years. Until we understand that, we can't understand anything going on over there.
Yes, it's interesting, and it's rather ironic that many of my Afghan friends have said for years now that one of the first projects that should be undertaken by the Americans once we have control of Afghanistan is to develop an irrigation project in the Helmand Valley. In the Helmand Valley, currently only dry farming is feasible. And because the opium poppy can thrive in a semi-arid region, that is the primary product, cash product, that is being grown now in the Helmand Valley. If that area were irrigated, we could grow cash crops that would feed at least 20% of the entire population of Afghanistan. But obviously at this stage, there is no such interest in such a project or such a type of agrarian reform, because more people would live a better quality of life, drug abuse would diminish, and the nation would begin to prosper. We don't want that.
We really don't want that. We do want that opium to come, continue to be produced and distributed and disseminated with the CIA's help. Why? Because the CIA has been behind the drug smuggling, as I said earlier, for 50 years, and anybody wants to document that, from the CIA's own records. We actually have the Inspector General's report, and you can get that off of Michael Rupert's website from the Wilderness. There's a link to the CIA website. I don't know if it's still up. It was a few months ago. We have a copy of it. This was the CIA Inspector General report saying, yes, certain elements within the CIA were involved in drugs. And if that came out publicly, why didn't we hear it? Why it came out just the day before or the same day that the Monica Lewinsky scandal broke? And which did the media cover? Monica Lewinsky.
Yes, unfortunately.
And then but as far as the future of America and as far as morality and what's right and wrong and the implications of high government officials being involved in drug smuggling, well, the CIA drug smuggling connection was far more important than Monica Lewinsky and her stupid immorality.
Yes. And, of course, there were other issues that were also covered under the rug because of that scandal, such as our giving away of secrets to the People's Republic of China during that same period of time.
Building up the best enemy that America could, American tax money could buy. And then, of course, the Chinese gives those secrets to the North Koreans and to the Iranians and the Pakistanis and the Saudi Arabians and the Libyans. And then we wonder why we're in so much trouble today when all of these countries are building missiles with our technology. And I don't think for one minute that Bill Clinton did that because he wanted a couple of $100,000 for campaign contributions. That's simply the cover. We can't let the American people know the truth, that we create the best enemies our own money could buy.
Yes. Now, more recently, Dr. Stan, I've been in touch with the acting prime minister of the East Turkestan government in exile. And I've had this individual on as my guest a few times on Sound Off, our radio program. And he's told me off the air that he was rather disappointed with the U.S. government a few weeks ago because he was holding a constitutional convention to more or less establish a constitution for his government in exile. And he wanted representatives from Uyghurs who now currently reside in various parts of the world to attend. But for some reason, the U.S. Department of State turned down 85% of all applicants who would simply come in to attend these meetings and then leave the next week. They had no means to take refuge here in the United States. They were well established in their respective nations.
But now, what is the nation that he represents?
East Turkestan.
East Turkestan. Okay, and fine. That's over adjacent to China, isn't it?
This coincides with the area that we commonly would refer to as Western China or Xinjiang.
That's occupied then by the communists.
Yes.
And of course, the thing, these are Muslims. They were conquered by the Chinese communists, and we support the Chinese communists' claim to their property rather than the right of the people to have a democratic society.
Yes. Well, the same is true of Tibet. The Tibetans resisted as heroically as they could. Back in 1989, the fellow who was in charge of the Chinese army in that region was a fellow by the name of Hu Jintao. Well, Hu Jintao is currently the commander-in-chief, if you want to call him that, of the People's Republic of China. He has gained control of the People's Liberation Army as well as the Chinese Communist Party in Beijing. So he currently has more power than the previous ruler of China.
Well, was it Chairman Mao who said political power comes out of the muzzle of a gun? So
yes.
He who controls the military, who controls the police, really controls the society. And that's why, of course, they usually like to have, the head of the of Russia come from the KGB. People like Andropov,
yes.
People like Gorbachev, people like Vladimir Putin, who is currently the, we call him the democratically elected. He's really president of Russia. He's really the dictator over there,
yep.
A former member of the KGB, as was, of course, both Andropov and Gorbachev, because, of course, they understand. Even though our leaders don't seem to, political power comes out of the muzzle of a gun. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest is John Spring. John, we got about 3 minutes for you to wrap up the program.
Well, we were just talking a moment ago about Hu Jintao, who now has more power than Jiang Zemin did a few months ago. The situation is becoming very serious in the Far East. It's very possible during this coming spring that mainland China and the People's Liberation Army will invade Taiwan. But, of course, there's no inkling of support for Taiwan here in the United States. The State Department is determined basically to support the People's Republic of China,
and betray our former friends in Taiwan. As somebody once said, with enemies, with friends like the United States, you really don't need any enemies.
Yes. So basically, my plea to your audience would be the same plea to my own audience. Be aware of what is happening throughout the world, and keep listening to good programs like Dr. Stan's Radio Liberty and Sound Off, and do the best you can to spread the word to as many fellow patriots as possible, and whenever possible, contact our leaders in Washington and hope and pray that they might listen.
Okay, John, well, I certainly appreciate everything that you do down there. And would you like to get your telephone number out one more time, your website out? People know how to listen to you.
Yes. When we're on the air every Sunday at 4 p.m., our toll-free number is 1-866-584-3434. We're at AM 15 on the AM dial, KSPA, and our website for that hour is www.crusaderadio.com.
And, of course, if people would like to get in touch with you in any way, how would they reach you?
They would reach us, care of me, John W. Spring, at Post Office Box 18946, Anaheim, California, 92817.
Give that address one more time. You have to give them twice.
Yes, that's P.O. Box 18946, Anaheim, California, and the zip code is 92817-8946.
Well, John, thank you very much for being our guest again this evening, and thank you for everything you're doing to try to awaken the American people. And I really feel there is a stirring out there. People are listening. They're hearing the truth, and initially they may reject it, but as they hear it more and more, why more and more again begin to realize the implications of what you're saying. So God bless you, and look forward to having you back on our program here in the not-too-distant future.
Well, it's always a pleasure, and if I don't talk to you beforehand, you and your wonderful family have a Merry Christmas.
We will, and you too.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, fine. Well, this is Dr. Stan, I guess, this evening, John Spring, and, of course, I hope you've enjoyed a very, very casual program. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and, this is the time when we have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and if you listen to our programs and you think that the message we have is important, we do hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because that's how we're able to do what we do 5 hours every day. So you can listen to us somewhere in America on radio 5 hours a day, certainly on the Internet 5 hours a day, on satellite 5 hours a day, certainly on the shortwave 4 hours a day, and of course it's all expensive, but we're primarily listener supported, and you can reach us if you'd like to at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, if you'd like to get a copy of our October newsletter, it goes into the secret society that came to America in 1640 to take over America. And today, its descendants of that secret society are in total working control of both of our political parties. So if you'd like to get a copy of that newsletter, and this is not what I say, this is what they say, and they tell you about what their plans are, what they're going to do, and it's an amazing, amazing story, and how the secret society ties into the First Bank of the United States and the Second Bank of the United States, and, of course, to what's happening now economically and financially of what was once the land of the free and the home of the brave. Well, we hope that many of you, of course, will call us at 1-800-544-8927, that you'll want to get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, that you'll want to get our video, Iraq, the Untold Story. You can get that with a syllabus. Sustainable Development, or Sustainable Development and the Road to World Government, either one of those are both very good. And then, of course, the syllabus goes with that, the Sustainable Development syllabus. We hope, of course, that many of you will go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com, and look at the various items we carry. And we do carry both a big Berkey water filter and the Berkey light water filter and of course, the extra filters for that, if you'd like. We do, of course, carry the Robinson Homeschool Curriculum and the Sanjian Radio. We, of course, carry all sorts of books and videos and four tape sets, information you won't get elsewhere. If you have any question at all about the fact that there has been organized effort to damage the minds of our children and to dumb them down so they'll be incapable of thinking effectively, you need to get our four tape set on water fluoridation. You need to get our four tape set on mercury. You need to get our four tape set on aspartame, and certainly you'll want to get a copy of our November newsletter. And, of course, we'll be glad to send you either one of our newsletters. The November newsletter deals with the idea that by the use of diet, injections, and injunctions, we'll be able to change the character of the American people. That quotation, the use of diet, injections, and injunctions, that quote comes from Bertrand Russell's book of the Impact of Science on Society, published in 1953, and we, of course, talk a great deal about that in our upcoming November newsletter, which hopefully will be available very, very soon. But they are poisoning the drinking water of our children. You have to understand that high levels of fluoride are present in your Cokes. They're present in your Pepsi. They're present in your cornflakes. They're present in your vegetables. And of course, vegetables are too smart to absorb the fluoride through their roots, so we spray it on there so you'll get a sizable dose. And of course, we convince you to brush your teeth with fluoride, and we put it in your drinking water, and we put it, you know, in the pesticides that are used on the food that you use, and then we add it to your food just to make sure you get a toxic dose, because it's a wonderful means of controlling the minds of the people, and of course making them much more malleable, changing their character so they'll not be able to think effectively. And we wonder why things are happening that are happening in America today. You want to get our November newsletter, you want to get the four tape set on water fluoridation, you want to get the book The Fluoride Deception by Chris Bryson, and hopefully you want to hope you'll want to support Radio Liberty. So until tomorrow at the same time, Dr. Stan goodbye, and may the Lord be with you.